Blog Talk Radio.
Burgeoning oil industry. The paper revealed here for the first time raised new questions over Britain's involvement in the war, which had divided Tony Blair's cabinet. In the midst of a series of meetings between ministers and senior oil executives are at odds with the public denials of interest from oil companies and Western governments at the time. The documents were not offered as evidence in the ongoing Chilcot inquiry into the UK's involvement in the Iraq War in March 2003, just before Britain went to war, and Shell denounced reports that it had held talks with Downing Street over Iraq oil as highly inaccurate. BP denied that it had any strategic interest in Iraq, while Tony Blair described the oil conspiracy theory as the most absurd. But documents from October and November the previous year paint a very different picture. 5 months before the March 2003 invasion, Baroness Simons, then the trade minister, told BP that the government believed British energy firms should be given a share of Iraq's enormous oil and gas reserves as a reward for Tony Blair's military commitment to U.S. plans for regime change. The papers show that Lady Simons agreed to lobby the Bush administration on BP's behalf because the oil giant feared it was being locked out of deals that Washington was quickly striking with U.S., French, and Russian governments and their energy firms. I can remember this happening back then, and I brought it up on my radio shows, you know, the collusion that was going on there at the time. There was no doubt about it. And of course, the Downing Street memos and all the other stuff. Minutes of a meeting with BP Shell and BG, formerly British Gas, on October 31st, 2002, read that Baron Simone asked that Baroness, rather, Simone agreed that it would be difficult to justify British companies losing out in the Iraq in the way if the UK had been had itself been a conspicuous supporter of the U.S. government throughout the crisis. The meeting then promised to report back to the companies before Christmas on her lobbying efforts. The Foreign Office invited BP in on November 6, 2002, to talk about opportunities in Iraq post-regime change. Its minutes state, Iraq is the big oil prospect. Okay, BP is desperate to get in there and anxious that political deals should not deny them the opportunity. After another meeting, this one in October 2002, the Foreign Office Middle East Director at the time, Edwin Chaplin, noted Shell and BP could not afford not to have a stake in Iraq for the sake of their long-term future. We were determined to get a fair slice of the action for UK companies in a post-Saddam Iraq. Whereas BP was insisting in public that it had no strategic interest in Iraq, in private, it told the Foreign Office that Iraq was more important than anything we've seen for a long time. BP was concerned that if Washington allowed total final else existing, contact with Hussein to stand after the invasion, it would make the French conglomerate the world's leading oil company. BP told the government it was willing to take big risks to get a share of the Iraqi reserves and second largest in the world. And over 1,000 documents were obtained under Freedom of Information over 5 years by the oil campaigner Greg Muttit. They revealed that at least five meetings were held between civil servants, ministers, and BP and Shell in late 2002. The 20-year contracts signed in the wake of the invasion were largest in the history of the oil industry. They covered half of Iraq's reserves, 60 billion barrels of oil, brought up by companies such as BP and CNPC, which is a Chinese National Petroleum Company. And also joint consortium alone stands to make $658 million profit per year from the Rumelia field in South Iraq. So, it's amazing, you know, it's amazing how they've got them red-handed here. Last week, Iraq raised its oil output to the highest level for almost a decade, 2.7 million barrels a day, and seen as especially important at the moment given the regional volatility and the loss of Libyan output. And many opponents of the war suspected that one of Washington's main ambitions in invading Iraq was to secure a cheap and plentiful source of oil. And we knew that all along. It was, you know, blood for oil. Oh, God. And we're still paying for it. Guys are dying every day over there. They just blew up 150 people. I was going to read that tonight. So, anyway, let's go on. You can read this on the independent.co.uk. Very, very good. Secret memos expose link between oil firms and the Iraq invasion. I really liked this article when I saw it, and I was most impressed. Was that finally? And I want, the reason I say this is I watched the Senate hearings on the Goldman. On the 2008, Senate investigated a two-year investigation on the cause of the 2008 financial collapse of the banking industry. And so we found out that what happened was they put together this thing. This was on C-SPAN that I saw it on. And Senator Levin of Michigan was delivering. He was the chairman of that subcommittee, and he was very good job explaining it. I believe it's a 5,800 page document. I'm not sure with the addendums and so on, but it looked like basically it was about 575 pages, if I'm not mistaken. Something like that, was the indictment, four specific indictments against Goldman Sachs, all right, and other, other companies, and especially Hank Paulson, who was the, a great beneficiary of that nightmare, convinced everyone to bail out the banks instead of and steal from the people and bail out the banks. And this fraud has finally been revealed, and I'm so pleased that it has. And having watched it, that looks like these companies are about to meet their makers. So the Goldman Sachs, an executive charged with fraud. The Securities and Exchange Commission Friday charged Goldman Sachs and company. And one of the executives with fraud in a risky offshore deal backed by subprime mortgages that cost investors more than $1 billion. The SEC also contended that Goldman allowed a client, Wall Street hedge fund Paulson & Company, and Paulson meaning Hank Paulson's hedge fund, former Treasury Secretary, present Secretary of Treasury under this 2008 fiasco, and to help select the securities to be sold. Paulson, in turn, bought insurance against the deal, and when the securities tanked, losing almost all their value, Paulson made a $1 billion profit. And a civil fraud charges were the first to be filed against Goldman, the prestigious Wall Street investing banker titan, that at the center of multiple inquiries into the cause of the global financial meltdown. Paulson has acknowledged that it reaped a $3.7 billion profit by betting against the housing market as it nosedived in 2006 and 2007. These guys are responsible for that to happen. Securities cited by the SEC were part of a series of offshore sales known as Abacus, A-B-A-C-U-S. The Goldman Executive Vice President, Fabrice Touré, 31, was Goldman Executive Vice President. Imagine that. 31 years old, Fabrice Touré, is principally responsible for structuring the Abacus deal. He must be a genius, Deal known as 2007 AC1. A so-called synthetic package in which investors didn't buy any actual securities. Instead, they bet on the performance of a specified bundle of home loans to marginally qualified buyers. The complaint filed in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York charged Touré with making materially misleading statements and omissions to investors. Cornelius Hurley, a former counsel to the Federal Reserve Board, who now heads the Boston University Law School, Moran Center for Banking and Financial Law, called the complaint stunning and said it raises at least two questions. Was this an isolated incident at Goldman, or did the firm engage in similar egregious practices in other deals? And did other Wall Street firms engage in similar practices? It appears that the financial protection provided by Goldman and described in the SEC complaint may have been more akin to the kind of protection provided by organized crime, Hurley said. Now, remember, this is being this is from the Alexander Higgins blog. Okay, I'm reading this from, and I'm not sure who the author is. Posted by Alexander Higgins. So this is one of four articles, I guess, and very, very good so far. I'm very impressed. But if you want to get to this, you go to Alexander Higgins' blog, okay, and you can find that article right there on the front page. Goldman said in the statement, the SEC charges are completely unfounded in law, in fact, and we will vigorously contest them and defend the firm and its reputation. Throughout sustains itself through tax-deductible donations from our readers, or rather, Truth Out. Okay, this is from Truth Out. Please make a contribution, okay? Okay, this article is taken from Truth Out, I guess. Still trying to figure that one out. But anyway, the product was new and complex, but the deceptions and conflicts are old and simple. Guzzani said in a statement, Goldman wrongly permitted a client that was betting against the mortgage market to heavily influence which mortgage securities to include an investment portfolio, while telling other investors that the securities were selected by an independent, objective third party. And the deal, one of about two dozen similar bundles in the Abacus series, closed on April 26, 2007. Paulson paid Goldman about $15 million for structuring and marketing the deal, right? And within 6 months, 83% of the mortgage-backed securities in a bundle had been downgraded, and 27% were placed on negative watch by Wall Street ratings agencies, the complaint stated. By the following January 29th, it said 99% of the portfolio had downgraded, costing investors more than $1 billion. Gee, I mean, these guys are serious crooks. Absolute, unbelievable crooks that they did to their investors, and then what the ripple effect did to everybody else in this country, you know? I don't know, it just amazes me. Yeah, it just amazes me how it's so easily duped, you know? This one might be interesting. It's community organization helps homeless people take over foreclosed property. Squatters move into foreclosed homes as seen on whatever. This is a YouTube thing.
So, I am an ordinary American citizen who is trying to provide for his family, trying to keep a roof over his head, and trying to be a positive part of a community. I haven't had work for, you know, almost a year and a half. My unemployment is run out. I've been looking for jobs. I go to temp agencies, and I put in a lot of effort to do a job search, but I'm eventually, at this point, looking at homelessness.
It's a disability. I'm going to stay on a disability check every month. through upset agencies. They made the minimum wage at the most. And both of our incomes combined, you know, it's shrinking. I mean, this is not nothing now. And if you only have them 2 years, you're looking for a job. They're not there. So what would you really expect us to do when you're facing addiction and homelessness? Okay? And thank God that Payback Land is there. The way this gives us enough time to work and do what we need to do to build ourselves up again.
Take Back the Land Rochester is a community organization, and which is part of a larger movement, which is seeking to make housing a human right and to have community control over housing and land, and by means of taking direct action, provide directly for people. So, for instance, doing moving families and into foreclosed homes to liberate them to be used for people. And not just for the banks, not just for profit. In Rochester, we have over 2,000 vacant homes that are just sitting there while we have people losing their homes. We have thousands of homeless people, so we want to match people with homes with homeless people.
So we're going to one of those places, and we're going to try to recover there. We're going to watch the place become a positive part of the community. And, you know, I actually think we'll become an asset, because with all the empty houses around, vandalism is an option. People that don't care about, you know, the property will go to the house and we'll take care of it. And when it becomes time to go off independently, we'll do that.
Our primary concern is not what's legal and illegal, but what's moral and immoral. I think it's immoral for people to be out on the street when there's thousands of houses that are still in good condition. That could be used for people. We want to make sure that through this dramatic action, so one, we actually fill a need, support people that are going through hard time and that need a house, and also dramatize the issue of housing and how housing is affecting our community. And we're having one of the worst, most severe economic and housing crisis of our generation.
I'm out there every day fighting for my family, fighting for my right to live in a decent place. It's a quality of life issue. I'm out there every day doing anything and everything possible to make ends meet, okay? I don't want to be given anything from anybody. I'm an able-bodied man. I don't drink. I don't do drugs, okay? I have business interests and entrepreneurial interests. I have the desire in my heart to work, but a system that does not provide jobs, does not provide me that opportunity.
Exactly. You have to say, my fiance, would you let me go out there every day to provide for the family? Okay, it's not good enough. But when we can't get the correct employment and pay enough to help us keep a roof over our, I'm into the sickness. And it's getting worse every day. Nobody cares about that. I have two children. Where's my 2 children with me? They just sleep in the park. Women say, this is not right. It's not. And it hurts. Because he tries so hard to take care of us.
A lot of goals and dreams are being destroyed. But there's one thing that I know. Say I have hope. I didn't have that a little while ago. Today I'm one step closer to becoming independent again, maybe gainfully employed with a sustainable wage. Today I'm going to be warm. I'm going to be fed.
That was from YouTube, and I hope you go to that again. Squatters move into foreclosed homes on YouTube. Very good. You released 1 second. I think I got George Dixon on the line here. Hang on 1 second. Hey, George, are you with me?
How you doing, Leo?
Hey, thanks for joining us. I appreciate you. A little earlier than I thought. So what do you... Thanks for George is going to fill in a little bit for me here tonight. Got kind of squeezed for time here tonight, and I needed a guest, and I was I asked George about a couple hours ago if he'd do the show, and he said yes. So I really appreciate that, George. Thank you.
Oh, this is old time radio for me, Leo, especially with you, and you know we're going back here to FM broadcasting, you know, and
You know that feel. That's why I keep that two hour Tuesday, you know. I didn't want to lose that.
It was great, and I loved your audience. I've been trying to follow you the best I can still. And I was intrigued by that article that you just videoed or audioed. It strikes home because there are a lot of foreclosures going on right now, and what the hell are we going to do with them?
Well, the thing is, too, is that now what's happened is those a lot of those foreclosures have been ruled uncollectible, all right, mm-hmm. because they were fraudulent in the making, and people are getting their houses back, or their those houses are just sitting there, not being, you know, you can probably buy them back taxes, you know what I mean?
But it's
a mess. And I think, you know, it was an organization that was helping people move into these foreclosed homes, just, you know, breaking in and letting them take their stuff, put it in there, you know. They're all boarded up and stuff, you know what I mean?
Well, so, you know, I thought it was only a matter of time before somebody moves on it because they were going to have to, Leo.
Well, nature can't tolerate a vacuum, you know, and that's what happened. The physics of it, the balance was out of balance, you know, and had to come back somehow. So it's leveling itself out, you know. It's just not right, George, that people should be living in $1 trillion mansions with your taxpayer dollars. For you, you know, stealing your dollars, okay, when those poor people are sitting out there in the streets because they can't get a job, because the banks aren't lending the money that you gave them, you know? So it's a ridiculous situation.
Well, you know, it is a ridiculous situation, but you have to understand that things have changed. And here we have a situation where you have a whole class of people that are out of work because with all the downsizing and everything else in government or in businesses, these people have been left without a job. And, you know, what do you do? In the meanwhile, you have all these different houses and so forth that have gone vacant. You are going to have people who are going to step in and take over and try to utilize them the best they can, but understand it's better than having none, because what happened in Russia, and this is one example that could follow very easily here, what the people did is that they ran through and destroyed whole towns by eliminating all metals that the town had to offer. I mean, people were killing neighbors because one would steal pots and pans because of the aluminum that they know they would get a buck or get something out of at the smeltering yard.
Yeah.
And I don't think that it could come to that, but we are capable of that's what could happen with total anarchy. You know, you would have people going after and gathering whatever they could to bargain with or something that has some value. And, you take a look at the fear right now that's being raised by the banking industry. And, you know, everybody talks about now we're going to a new Amero dollar, just like the Europeans went to the Euro dollar at the time. It could be possibly be a move coming soon with this administration that could point in that direction. And, you know, like, it changes everything.
Yeah. No,
don't you agree, Leo?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. Yeah, you know what I was going to do? There was something here I wanted to ask you about. There was a... I thought I'd play this this audio. It's only about 3 minutes long, but it's about aliens are on the moon. Solid evidence, okay? And the real reason why they haven't been back to the moon, okay? That's about 10 minutes, but this section here, the aliens are on the moon, solid evidence. I was wondering if you'd listen to that with me and comment on this.
Oh, I love it. Old-time radio.
Yeah,
keep it coming. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll play this. It's only 3 minutes, and we can comment on it because it's kind of like this is saying this. I'm looking at a black and white picture here, but it's saying that there's solid evidence here that that aliens are on the moon. So let's check this one out.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, wouldn't you know? Embedded disabled by request. Oh man. Well, why put it up there then? Damn you. I'm sorry, I can't. Oh, that really pisses me off, you know. But anyway, okay. So there's something else I wanted you to comment on tonight. Was this particular?
Well, let's go back here.
You took
the video off the YouTube.
The video. I can't play it because it's dead. You know, they took it out.
Video, and let's. Let's run through this. What do you remember that was on the video?
They're just showing. I seen a couple of them like that, and that's what brought it up. It's hard to explain. They're showing like flying saucer type things around the moon. All right, with telescopes, telescopic views of these strange. Disc type things. It's a weird video, and it's filmed at night, so I didn't really agree with it. But I thought you might, knowing UFOs like you do, and understanding that, you might have shed some light on it. But since I can't play the video and people don't know what they're talking about, I wanted to ask you something else that I know you know a lot about.
I do know a lot about this. You know that. I don't want to pass this over, but go ahead.
The other one is another level of your knowledge is the esoteric meaning of the twin pillars of Boaz and Jachin. Okay, and these are the two pillars of the Masonic pillars, and this article goes into it. I didn't know if you might be able to shed some light on that too. But
no, I don't want to go into that one.
Maybe if I get time, I'll read it later. Hang on a second. Where were we? Oh, on the thing. On the alien thing.
I was referring to the activity on the moon, right, yeah. And you know,
wait just a second. Let me see if this one is available. No, that's gone too. Okay. Maybe you can, since there's no video or audio available, maybe you can enlighten us on,
Well, you know, Leo, the moon always, I always had some kind of a love for the moon. And, in following the UFO phenomena, the moon was always connected with it somehow, and mainly with ancient folklore dealing with civilizations of antiquity. And one, there are many, but one was a relationship that we had with a race of being from Nibiru, the Anunnaki.
Just 1 second,
this was...
Okay. I've got this narration. No, it's all music and video. There's just a bunch of pictures showing different UFOs. Nothing, you know. There's no narration to it. Sorry, George.
Well, there's so many different connections to the moon, but basically it was a way station, and you know, with some of the evidence in the 90s, I caught some of the evidence from pictures that were taken by the astronauts. And these basically were taken by NASA's cameras. And I don't think NASA realized what they printed. And inside these pictures, there was pictures of actually complexes and three-dimensional dome-type buildings. And
I remember, George, when I first met you, Billy introduced me to you. We were talking, and that was the first time you mentioned.
Marshall, you're referring to, yeah.
The lunar civilization, you know, the pictures that were taken then. And I remember Billy. I remember you and Billy didn't quite ever believe you on that one. I don't think. And he used to tease you about that, but I was impressed that and of course the pictures on Mars, you know, so you know that our solar system has been colonized, probably how many billions of years, you know, who knows, but
right.
the evidence that there have been other civilizations. Has been covered up, and I'm sure it has. So just to not do, I don't know. You know, why would they cover that up? I guess if the search for other civilizations has been going on for God knows how many millennium, man's been asking, you know, if he's alone or not. I would think that it would be something they'd want to share with the world. You know what I mean? Don't you think it's time now under this Mayan calendar? that this kind of information is suddenly becomes open and we see our alien brothers, you know, and sisters.
Well, it has been open the whole time, but after understanding the academic eyes that are reviewing this and actually. You know, releasing this information to the public is a different story. But the problem is now that it's beyond that illusion of control, and it's where basically it's general knowledge. And, you know, it's, I think, the potentials of who and what we are, I think, is coming to the surface. And part of that is because of the times that we're experiencing right now and how much the ancients or people of the past had to say regarding what we would be experiencing right now. And that is what they talked about. And, you know, it's hard to believe this, but we are those people that we've been waiting for. And the reason why is because we are experiencing the end of this initial dive into, let's say, this pool of consciousness being three-dimensional reality. And now we have the opportunity to continue on in this way, or to come out of the water and go into a different form of this existence or this experience. And, you know, we talked about quantum physics and quantum consciousness and understanding that all things are happening at the same time. And we are just experiencing or focusing in on one event out of many, 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 many that are going on. And we are part of a unity consciousness that, first of all, accepts the hereplay of these many, many consciousnesses that are being played out, and not one over the other than they are all part of the synchronicity that we are all attached to, and that's because of this three-dimensional domain that we are locked into. And this is changing.
Yeah, I got you. Yeah. No, I know. In fact, I was looking at, briefly, I didn't get a chance to get through the whole thing, but Callaghan?
Right.
The guy in Europe who figured out the Mayan calendar?
Yes.
Callaghan or Callaghan? You know what I'm talking about?
It's Kalaman.
Kalaman. There you go. I was attached to. I linked somehow. Has got linked to his website. I think it was somebody on Facebook sent it to me, and it was about his talking about the. He's really, really, really seriously. Engaged right now with this and Mayan calendar in the next year, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about the significance of it and the time and space aspect of this period will diminish. You know, it won't exist anymore as we know it. So I think that is exciting as hell, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's an exciting message, don't you think?
Yeah, I think he's tapped into some kind of a pattern that is being played out.
Right.
And of course, his pattern goes back to 16 billion years ago, which
right.
I think is a hell of a long time. What do you think?
Well, the fact that they could possibly consider that number, all right, at that time, all right, billions? I mean, you know, you have to wrap your head around the size of a billion.
Well,
billion years.
The reason that we had the individual, consciousness.
Right.
Hold on for one second here.
Yeah.
Had the individual consciousness, let's say, to direct our own livelihood, and
right.
let's take it back to Homo sapiens. You know, from the first time we were identified here in the Earth.
Right.
So, you know, this... anyways.
I know what you're getting at. I think we might want to remind me of what we were talking about there. I lost my track. What was the discussion?
I think in expanding on Kalaman's work, he took a paradigm of understanding.
Yeah, we were talking about the one, 16.1. Now, this is even funnier. 16.1 billion years ago. Okay, 16.4.
Oh, is it 16.4?
Yeah, 16.4. 4 billion years ago, you know, it's so bizarre, you know, to be able to comprehend such a large number in terms of existence of years on this planet. We started off as whatever. It took something like what, 2 or 3 billion years or something before we were able to become an amoeba, right?
That's right. It was in different stages of this evolution that we've experienced it. And basically, it's 9 levels. And on each level, we actually lose 20%. Or I should say, time is speeding up. So understand that
we lose 20% of what now? We lose 20% of the...
actual speed of the cycle that they're in.
I see. So it gets slower and slower or faster and faster?
Well, it reverses itself to where it started from. It's like following the movement of phi backwards towards the beginning, or the golden mean spiral back to the beginning.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay. Right.
What we're experiencing right now is we're experiencing now a return. Return of the energy that put us in this motion, and in this three-dimensional motion, and I could go off different ways here, Leo. It has to do with, I think, the precession of the equinox and having an understanding of that, and I think that would give us an understanding of where our evolution is and has been, let's say, for the last 12,000 years, because we have evidence of this. And what we're having now is a repeat of what happened, let's say, 12,000 years ago. And, this is something that's happened before, and it will happen again. And we are just a living proof of the return of the cycle, if you'd want to call it that. But what is to our advantage is that our intellectual technology at this point is pretty close to the technology that we had at the fall of the last cycle that we experienced, which was in 9772 BC, give or take a few years here or there. But that was basically the last cataclysm that the Earth has gone through. And even at that time, the rotation of the Earth reversed itself and turned it in the opposite direction. So understanding that it took mankind almost 20,000 years for itself to regain its strength or itself out of that whirlpool of changes that they went through. And the only way I can explain this is like a computer where our memory is part of our hard drive. And if something erases your hard drive, what happens is that you have to reload your programs into or information back into the hard drive. And that basically is what happened to us. When this happened and the polarity, electromagnetic polarity of this world altered itself, it erased basically our biological memory. And since then, it was trying to relearn the information that we had before we lost our memory. And when I say that, I remember the information that we had, and I would have to say that the Great Pyramid of Giza, I do believe, was built right before the last time this happened. And some of that correlates to Edgar Cayce's work, where he talks about the pyramids being built about 1050 BC. And it was at that time that it was the knowledge that us, I'm talking about Homo sapiens, part of this Adam and Eve gene, a genoseed, that came out of that, this is what we were able to produce. And this has nothing to do with the lesser gods or there's a lot of references to in the Bible that make reference to Enlil and Enki and Anu, who are part of this Nephilim connection, dealing with a Nephilim race from the Bureau.
All right. Now, I we've done so many shows on that. It was wonderful. We got a nice audience for that. And I noticed that our archives are still swelling on those shows. They're still we're getting a lot of interest in those programs over the years that we've talked about them.
They're going to continue with the moon, because if nothing else, that is a hot subject that's being played not only in the media, but also I think it has to do with that outside connection that the Mayans were talking about, meeting up with our galactic neighbors, if you'd want to call it that.
Right. Well, and, you know, I noticed that there was a Time magazine or one of the major magazines. I noticed on a stand somewhere recently had an article on was it on aliens or it was on aliens, you know.
Yeah, all right. There's been a lot of shows on TV.
I mean, a lot of programming, but a lot of stuff. And it's kind of like the article was about these aliens, not these aliens, the evidence supposedly that was come out on aliens or spacecrafts and so on. You know, the whole stuff just reweaved, basically. I mean, but I did notice that it's in a... most of that stuff used to be taken up by the tabloids, you know. But now I'm noticing that some of the mainstream Time magazine, that kind of thing, are focusing in on it now. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that in the next few months. We see much more of it. You know, about alien evidence of alien existence, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, I think it's coming out now. It's all, you know, it's... I think it's been exposed, but if nothing else, it's been a diversion too. And you know, I would like to see an intervention at this point, and maybe help us deal with some of what's going on in the world. Focusing right in Japan, you know, these poor people. I feel so sorry for them, but yet my heart goes out to them, and. I'd like maybe a sort of intervention to help us deal with our problem. Yes, we do live here, yes. But if not, maybe it's connecting with somebody who maybe has gone through this before, yes. If not, maybe connect us with maybe what is another course of action. And, you know, I do believe that right now, with the technology and the knowledge that we do have, that we would be able to rectify maybe 98% of our problem right now. And this is including the atomic waste problem that we find right now with these nuclear power plants. We have the technology, and the elders tell us about this technology, and they talk about the times that we will go before the ending, where we will join and become co-creators of that time period, you know, from 2012 on. And, you know, this, you know, could go into... I could take it into heavy esoteric understandings dealing with you know, the soul and watching, you know, the growth of just consciousness experiencing this reality. You know, I do believe that we are all sentinel beings having a human experience, not a human having a spiritual experience. I really believe that. And I believe right now we are experiencing that which we already know. And we're at a point now where we don't have to wait around to get the whole picture anymore, because we have seen the whole picture for what it is. And it's a matter of, do you want to stay here or go on? And, in the Bible, you know, they talk about, in my houses there are many mansions. There are other realities above this three-dimensional reality that we experience, this illusion, if you'd want to call it, that we hold together, being masters of the energy fields around us, because that's all it is. It's just one big illusion that we are holding together and we are attaching ourselves to. But there are other dimensional realities to be experienced. These UFO connections that we have, there are many. With the government, there are like 56 plus 18 different cultures that have had contact with us, with the government, and or with the academic world. And let's just keep it on that level, in a sense. And that's a minute understanding of the relationship. But, they have an understanding, I think, of the particulars, I think, in trying to educate, the populace, first of all, and accepting the possibility. I think in showing that it is part of our evolutionary ability to either keep attached to this or to go on. And, you know, I'm going back into the early 90s where I seen the manipulation of, like, I think of the influence the educational world had on young children, just like Mr. Rogers and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, even though as a parent myself, I mean, it was a great show. But I think the writers and so forth, of what they built into some of the illusions that they were passing on, was the illusion of the strange being visiting these children while they were sleeping. And of course, these
I don't know what you, I don't know where you're getting on there now, the guy. I don't remember that in Mr. Rogers, but I was just thinking that, yeah, I mean, we've been so controlled over the years through what we've been watching as kids, you know, and just basically accepting everything that we see, like my dog, you know. But you know what I mean? It's like, you may question what it smells like. Yeah, it's food. Take it. But it's like what we are. And on that, I've got to thank you. I got Woody coming up here in just a few minutes. And I want to thank everybody and thank George. Thank you, George, for joining me tonight. And you can get a 1 hour of George every other week here, right, every Friday night, 8 to 9 o'clock. Please check the archives for our archives for on the Friday night with George Nixon shows that we've done. We just did one last week. It was a good show. We had a whole bunch of great shows with George and talked about all of this stuff. It's all in the archives. And, oh, man. We've talked about a ton of stuff, haven't we? George?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. We've covered a hell of a lot of ground
over
the last...
shows that remind me of those old-time radio years.
Yeah. Well, that's because of you, George. You keep it alive. Well, I'm going to thank you, George, for being with us tonight. And I'm going to I got Woody coming right up here, so we'll talk to you real soon. All right.
Okay, I'll be listening in. God be with you. Thank you, Leo.
Thanks for joining tonight. All right. Good night.
Adios.
Yeah. Right now we got Woody coming up. Woody in the ring, and let me please. Where's Woody's music? Woody in the ring, right here. All right, coming right up.
Down to Point South, I believe. Although your introduction was just as stellar as hers, Leo, let me assure you. Maybe we'll have to shake things up when she comes back.
I had you on mute for a second or two there, so I'm trying to operate two computers at the same time. So, my engineer here.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. We're missing a member of our team tonight, but I thought your introduction was just as stellar as hers, and maybe we'll shake things up when she comes back.
All right, maybe. All right, well, you take it away.
Two-man team. Anyway, good evening, sports fans. Watch your heads on the ropes as you step into the ring with Woody. Tonight's topics, Knicks, coulda, woulda, shoulda, player by DeBay, NHL playoffs, Madden head case, Bonds have to make Bond again, and averages. Okay, let's get right down to it. Only the finish matters in sports, and you might want to see the first pitch, the kickoff to a football game, but the only thing that really counts is who puts on the green jacket, who drives around in an oval with a checkered flag, and who has the most points in the end. That is the reality that haunts the Knicks as they prepare for Game 2 of their playoff series against the Celtics tonight at the TD Garden. They couldn't have played much better than they did for the first 45 minutes of Game 1 on Sunday. But it was the experience, the poise, and the savvy of the Celtics, along with a few cheap shots, that prevailed over the final 3 minutes, earning Boston an 87-85 victory. It marked what I think was the fifth time the Celtics had beaten the Knicks this year, the fourth time Boston had outscored New York in the fourth quarter, and the third time Knicks coach Mike D'Antonio's team had a decent chance to win and yet failed to close out in the end. Now, that's what the NBA playoffs are all about. Who can close games over the final minutes and secure a victory? The Knicks haven't learned how to do that yet against the Celtics. A puzzle that must be solved, or this best of seven series ain't going to last much longer. According to the Knicks coach, the biggest thing was he saw in the off day of practice at the TD Garden. How do you close out and win games against great teams? When they smell the end of the game, that's when they get really tough. You have to be super disciplined to be able to get over the hump. We've got to get a win or two wins to act like we know what we're doing. Now, a win tonight would definitely suffice. But to do that, the Knicks and D'Antoni must execute better in late-game situations than they did Sunday when they were outplayed and outcoached over the final 3 minutes when the Celtics turned an 82-78 deficit into a two-point victory. Now, the Knicks might complain about Carmelo Anthony being called for an offensive foul or for pushing off Paul Pierce with 21 seconds left or the no call after Tony Douglas was tripped trying to cover Ray Allen on a game-winning three-pointer. But, you know, when you're playing the Boston Celtics, when you're playing them in the playoffs, and when you're playing them, you know, on their home court, those are the kind of calls that teams that win you know, winning teams like the Celtics definitely get. I mean, those are the kind of calls the Lakers got back in the day. Those are the kind of calls the Bulls got back in the day. I mean, you know, in the NBA, I mean, you know, that's just how it is. Now, you might be a better, younger team. You know, I might be better, younger, almost as good. But in order to prove it, in order to be the man, you got to beat the man, you know, and that's just how it is. Now, here's what the Knicks need to do tonight, you know, to get some kind of breakthrough. Don't let Stoudemire disappear. He kind of, like, disappeared over the final, I think, 3 or 4 minutes after burning the Celtics for, like, 28 points, you know. And he put up 12 in the early part of the fourth quarter. And you got to give Boston's credit, you know, their defense for adjusting. But, you know, with Carmelo Anthony shooting 1 for 11 in the second half, losing Stoudemire, you know, brought the Knicks offense to a crashing halt. Anthony, Carmelo Anthony, must come through. It's clear D'Antoni wants to have the ball in the final seconds, and with Chauncey Billups likely to be out tonight, it will be Anthony's game to win. He can't repeat his shooting woes again, or the Knicks will definitely head down to the Garden, you know, no games to two. Don't get out, coach. Doc Rivers schooled D'Antoni in the final minutes, an isolation play for a jumper by Pierce, following a timeout with 2:05 left. Garnett alley-oop dunk in the inbound play with 37.3 seconds left, and the game-winning three-pointer by Allen, all were designed by Rivers. According to Celtics forward Jeff Green, he's an amazing coach. Most people expect the Celtics to win because of their experience in late-game situations. They've been there, done that, and have a banner to prove it. The Knicks are neophytes to all of this. Tonight, they have a chance. They have to prove that they've grown up. So, as I picked the Knicks to win this series because I thought the Knicks might be hungry, and the, you know, the Celtics are kind of old, and maybe this is the time you can push somebody off their throne a little bit. But they really should have won game one in order. That really would have helped them a great deal in order to do that. But, you know, game two tonight is going to be a lot tougher to win. Historically, the home team usually smashes the visitors in game two. Game one is usually a game that, you know, like stealable, you know. But usually, historically, as I said, historically, you know, it ain't it, you know. Things, you know, nothing's written in stone. That's why you play the games. But historically, game two, the home team usually comes out and smashes the visitor. So if the Knicks are able to win one tonight, I think, hey, it's definitely anybody's series, and you can be sure Madison Square Garden will be a rocket. All right, moving forward, Jason Bay, as you may know, is a New York Met outfielder. Now, you may not know because the guy's been injured so much, you would think he wasn't even on the team anymore. But the left fielder is almost ready. The final details leading to Jason Bay's welcome home party are in place. Now, it's all on the guest of honor's chest, or more precisely, the ribcage. Though the Mets were hopeful Flushing Bay would flood left field at Citi Field tonight against Houston for the start of a six-game homestand, the team brass yesterday decided the injured player would benefit more from two minor league rehab games, making Thursday the new target for his season debut. Bay, who huddled with general manager Sammy Olsen, manager Terry Collins, and members of the team's medical staff in New York, was sent back to Single-A St. Lucie because of forecasts for cold weather at Triple-A Buffalo and Double-A Binghamton. The Mets originally planned to have Bay play all the games for Buffalo if needed to continue for his rehab. The Mets lineup can certainly use a jolt after scoring only 5 combined runs and losing 2 of 3 games to the Braves over the weekend. But they have at least their 7-game losing streak with Sunday's 3-2 victory. According to Major Collins, I hope he's ready to hit. And when asked about Bay's looming return, you know, to get him back in our lineup means a lot. It will kind of put guys in, you know, in the right positions where everybody can really make a contribution now. Bay sustained the ribcage injury during batting in spring training 3 weeks ago. He was originally hopeful he would join the Mets on April 9th, a day after their home opener, but didn't begin swinging a bat until later. Let me just add this to that. As I said earlier in the season, one of the most common injuries now is the oblique tear, stress, whatever. You didn't see these, like, so much maybe 15 years ago, more closer to 15 years ago. Guys weren't in as great a shape. Now guys come in and they're ripped. so they're like they have like no little extra, you know, like extra fat to help them out and not stress something or whatever. So when you pull something, I mean, you're just straight up pulling the muscle. You don't got any little extra baggage on there. And I think that's why you see a lot more of these oblique issues. Anyway, swinging the bat is part of the game, man. You gotta swing, and that's a violent action. And, you know, you also got to throw and rotate. I mean, it's all hand-in-hand with that oblique stuff. Anyway, Manager Collins playing in spring training was to Bat Bay in fifth in order behind Carlos Beltran. I guess the manager is going to have to decide if Bay is ready to be thrust into the middle of the lineup or whether he would benefit from more of a transition period, kind of like what Carl Crawford's going through up in Boston. More on that a little later. We all know Jason's a great hitter, according to Angel Pagan. To have him healthy in the lineup, he's the kind of offensive guy we need in the lineup. He's going to be able to bring that to the table, and we are looking forward to that. We're going to have a lot better lineup with him. Well, that remains to be seen. He was a disappointment in the first year of a $66 million deal that runs through 2013. There's also a fifth-year vesting option. Last year, Bay hit .259 with six homers and 47 RBIs. Not what the Mets signed up for. If you remember, Bay was available and Matt Holliday was available all at the same time, and you know, everyone was crunching numbers and this and that and everything else. And how they ended up going to St. Louis, where he's done very well, and they love him out there, and the guy hits all the time, and so on and so forth. And Bay has come to the Mets and just kind of been injury plagued and not productive, and that field isn't really conducive to his swing, and definitely not with their. You know, if they thought they were going to get better, but they definitely haven't gotten that. Okay, moving forward, the NHL playoffs are going on, and, oh, that's right, nobody cares. So for the 10 people that care, tune in to somebody else. All right, Madden Headcase. Players planning to ascend to the NFL will face a stepped-up awareness about concussions, a cultural shift that safety proponents hope will filter down to the feeder levels through the popular Madden NFL video game. From the view of the Hall of Fame coach and former broadcaster the video game is named for, the game will reflect the real sports changes, and John Madden hopes players take head injuries more seriously as they develop. He is part of a safety-minded group educating incoming rookies on the protocols they'll encounter to deal with head injuries. If we can do it with the NFL, I think we can get a trickle down to college and high school telling players what a concussion is and being aware that when you get one, you can't play anymore. Madden said Monday in a conference outlining other safety updates. Madden said EA Sports Madden 2012 won't allow players suffering concussions to return to the game following the removal of helmet-to-helmet hits from previous versions. He said the aim is to raise awareness about the injury's severity and its consequences. As for the players who will be selected in next week's NFL draft, they will encounter changes on kickoffs, which move from the 35-yard line to from the 30. Atlanta Falcons president and NFL competition committee chairman Rich McKay hopes they will continue a mindset shift towards safety without sacrificing quality. I really do believe the culture has changed between the players, the coaches, the medical staffs for the good, McKay said. You have players and teammates much more willing to report injuries and specifically concussions, and I think the doctors have done a good job of standardizing for us the evaluation process and procedures for coming back to play. We're going to continue to push the rules we think will enhance player safety. Rich Eitelbogen, co-chairman of NFL's Head, Neck, and Spine Committee, added a continuing process includes equipment and how players use it. For now, it's getting players that walking away from a hard hit might be the biggest red flag. 90% of people that get concussions don't even get knocked out. They might be a little confused. They might have a headache. And they, you know, these are warning signs. If in doubt, we're going to sit the players because of the long-term effects of a concussion or the danger of playing with a concussion. Frankly, I think that's a step in the right direction. Concussions are very dangerous, and to send a guy back out there is just not safe for the guy. And you know, back in the old days, oh, you're a little groggy, here's a smelling salt. Get back in there, kid, you know, you're going to be all right. You know, those days are over, thankfully. You know, it's a great sport, and, you know, guys play it because they love it, and they're also earning a living. But to go out there and possibly die for it because you have a concussion and you're unaware of a linebacker hitting you from the blind side or something, anything along those lines, you know, or being crippled or anything that can happen. When you're out there on the field, you want to be 100% with your wits. So this is definitely a step in the right direction. You know, it does make people more aware, you know what I mean? You know, it's true, it's only a video game, but everybody knows, you know, about Madden, you know, everyone. So it's definitely a step in the right direction, and, you know, people need to be aware. So good stuff there. Kudos to the NFL and to Madden as well. Okay. Now, will Barry Bonds have to bond again? Now, what I mean is, you know, will he have to bond out again? Obviously, he's not going to get rearrested again or anything, but is he going to go to jail? Now, what is actually is obstruction of justice, because that's what Barry was convicted of. Now, it's when you interfere with police work, basically, or in the case of Bonds, giving evasive answers about whether or not, you know, a trainer injected him with human growth hormone. They did not convict him of lying to the grand jury. They convicted him of being, you know, slippery, I guess. What exactly did he do again? Well, these are prosecutors, they surprise us, and read to the trial jury what Bonds said back in 2003. There was only one conclusion you could draw. He was deliberately, criminally misleading and evasive, you know? Even if you don't lie, you still can't be evasive, I guess. It's kind of strange. Ralph not saying anything. So what exactly didn't he do? What didn't they, you know, they say he didn't do? Well, the jury was deadlocked 11-1, according to a San Francisco Chronicle report, in favor of convicting Bonds on the perjury charge, yet also were deadlocked in favor of acquittal on charges that Bonds had used steroids. U.S. District Judge Susan Ilston declared a mistrial on three other charges. Now, is he going to go to jail? Probably not. The judge, according to legal analysts, that presided over almost two identical cases, the Balco trials of disgraced cyclist Tammy Thomas and track coach Trevor Graham, both of whom were sentenced to home confinement. You get a lot of more out of Bonds by having him spending 1,000 hours working with kids than spending 6 months in prison. So, you know, they got the right judge, no jail time. And again, he'll probably be just, you know, doing some community service with the kids, which is it's good for the community. So, hey, what are you going to do? Could you go to jail for obstructing justice? As I said, not really. It's just, you know, it's San Francisco. They're kind of liberal out that way. He's good. He's not going to go to jail again. He's just going to get a little bit of community service, and maybe he'll get the home confinement. Maybe he'll get a bracelet or some type of thing for a couple months or whatever. But you know, I don't see it going any further than that. So. But again, you know, the next trial to come up, which, as I said, me personally, I think is going to be far more entertaining, is the Roger Clemens trial, which starts in July. As I said, he's already been running his mouth. Bonds was slick enough not to get on the stand, and I don't see Clemens being that smart. Clemens definitely will be getting on the stand. And he just can't help himself. I think his legal advice is absolutely horrible. So we'll see. I just think Bonds is going to explode on the stand. I mean, Clemens is going to explode. He's going to have a meltdown, and they're going to back him into a corner. And he's really going to tarnish what is already, you know, starting to be tarnished of a reputation. As I said, when this all started, he should have just kept his mouth shut and just let this go away. But he wanted to scream from the mountaintop that how an innocent man that he is. But we all know otherwise. If you're guilty and someone says you are, Don't scream it from the mountaintop how innocent you are. If you know you're guilty, just stop. Just let it go. It'll go away. You know, but he couldn't let it go. So that's not looking good. Not looking good for Clemens, but, you know, that's a couple months away. So we'll talk about that when it comes around. Now, let's talk about averages. I'm just going to run down the averages of the Boston Red Sox hitters and the Yankee hitters. We'll just kind of see where everyone's at. Now, the top hitter for Red Sox right now is Jed Lowry. He's batting .462. You got to like that. And the worst hitter is Jason Varitek, far below the Mendoza line. He's batting just .077. Now, the Mendoza line, as many of you may or may not know, is called 200. Anything under 200 is really super unacceptable. So just for the Red Sox, they seem to have a good number of guys batting under that or on that. Let's just take a look here. To be exact, you have Cameron batting 200, Ellsbury 196, Euclid 190, Screwball 188, McDonald 182, Saltamacchia 182, Crawford 127. Crawford, the most interesting one, one of the big all-season signings, not hitting all that great. I mean, Gonzalez is doing all right. I mean, he's hitting .269. He's got himself a couple home runs, I believe. But it's not looking good. A lot of guys are hovering around the 200 average, which is just not good. Now, again, it's early and it's still cold out, but you know, it just bears watching a little bit. Now, if you skip down to the Yankees, let's see who's not swinging the bat all that well for the Yankees. Nunez and Mahoney, they're batting zero, but guys that play every day. You have Gardner, Brett Gardner, who's, you know, batting 140, and he looks every bit of the 140. I mean, he gets into a lot of double plays. I mean, he just looks every bit of the 140. He just hasn't been swinging the bat all that well. It's too bad. Where we have the direct opposite, which was interesting, Eric Chavez is actually leading the Yankees with his batting average of .467. The guy's on fire. He's got a lot of clutch hits, some nice home runs. This is a great off-season signing. You know, this is another one of those deals where the Yankees grab somebody off the scrap heap, a former star, mind you, and, giving the guy a shot. Now, here's kind of what they say. You know, if you grab a jalopy and you grab the sloppy off the slop, off the heat there, and you put it back, and you try and make it nice, well, you still just kind of have a jalopy. But if you grab, like, an old Mercedes off the scrap heap, and you kind of shine it back up, well, hey, you got a nice Mercedes. And that's kind of what the Yankees have done with some of the signings that, you know, with some of the guys that they grabbed, you know, especially a lot of the pitchers, you know. Yeah, Sergio Garcia, Bartolo Colon deal, the Chavez deal. I mean, you know, they signed some guys that, you know, that back in the day, you know, in their heyday, they were they were all stars. So, it's kind of nice to see the Chavez, signing come to fruition. Didn't cost a lot of money, and the guy's a good player. Now, Posada, you know, he's batting .163. That's a nice clip below the Mendoza line. But that's where the buck stops. Everyone else is above the Mendoza line. Marcus Scherer just barely. He's at .220. But he's clipped off like 6-7 home runs, which isn't too bad. And Granderson, much the same, batting .240. But he's got a nice little clip of home runs. And Swisher's batting .260. So, I mean, The Yankees lineup is definitely hitting better for average than the Red Sox right now. It's early, but again, this kind of stuff that's interesting to watch. We'll see. You know, because every year some guys have career years and some guys have tank years. And last year the Yankees seemed to have a high number of guys having low averages, just way off for the years. And I think guys are much healthier this year, so it's going to be interesting to see. I think the Yankees lineup is going to be very dangerous come July once the weather's warmer and everyone's feeling a lot better. I just think the Yankees are just really going to you know, be putting a lot of runs on the board, and they're going to be getting into a lot of bullpens. So anyway, that's you know, it's a long season, and we'll just sit back and watch. So anyway, shout out to all my woodheads out there: Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy, Greg at AFS, everyone at the Northeast Athletic Club, my partner Money Mike, and the Cardio Kid. Let's enjoy some of this warm weather. I know it's raining, but the grass is getting green. Next thing you know, there'll be leaves on the tree. Until next week.
I like blues. I always did play it myself. One of the earliest chord progressions I ever learned on my guitar was a blues progression, and it's great playing blues. I don't know why. It's such a moody, real sound, you know. It just makes you feel good, you know. And it makes you feel better. And, you know, I never really felt blue listening to the blues. It makes you loud, some of them. But these particular instrumentals, I mean, the instrumentals are just great. And so many variations of those progressions and finger work and different personalities behind the guitar that, you know, that it just infused the blues with such a wide variety of emotion and talent, and created remarkable results. And boogie woogie and jazz and blues and, you know, all the great sounds, New Orleans jazz. And, yeah. So I just kind of appreciate the blues, and we hope to play a few more in the coming future of some of my collections. So, but anyway, I'd like to get back to this new documentary that investigates the war being waged by biotechnology companies against scientists who expose the truth about GMOs. And it's a hard-hitting new documentary, Scientists Under Attack, where genetic engineering and the magnetic field of money. German filmmaker Bertram Verhaag explores the heavy hand of the biotechnology industry in steering science towards its own interests and eliminating the actual legitimate science that exposes genetic engineering as the fraud that it is. Okay. And I'm just going to play this segment.
Attack on scientists is very well structured by the biotech industry. It's systematic, it's worldwide, it's very coordinated. It's part of the way that they do business.
What's, I think, very unique in my case is that I survived.
One of the reasons why we are lining up now is, of course, to protect ourselves against the attacks which will continue to come, of course, because we are obviously threatening to the markets of the producers of genetically modified organisms and other genetically engineered products.
Our discovery that we were finding transgenic corn maybe 1,000 miles from the nearest legal transgenic corn field was a huge problem for them, because it really showed very simply and with real evidence that they really did not have control.
No one gets up in the morning saying, "I want to go buy a genetically engineered food." They offer no benefits, no more nutrition, no more flavor, no nothing. They only offer risks.
His brilliant design showed that it wasn't the insecticide that caused the problems. It was somehow the process of creating the genetically engineered potato.
They asked me, "Would you eat it?" I said, "No, certainly not the GM potatoes we worked on. If I could avoid it, I would certainly avoid it."
The next morning, Arpad Pusztai was fired after 35 years and silenced with threats of a lawsuit.
They did not want people to have that knowledge and not want them to have that choice. So this isn't just a story about science. It's a story about knowledge, democracy, and freedom of choice.
They should not use our fellow citizens as human guinea pigs.
virtually every food that you consume, including you in Germany, has some genetically modified product in it, okay, whether it's soybeans or corn.
So remember that the animal that has been fed on GM has been changed. Now, when you are eating that animal fed on GM, you will be eating a different animal.
You can check that out at scientistsunderattack.com. Very good. And that's I want to see that film. Again, the name of the documentary is short list. Let's see. New investigates war being waged by biotechnology companies against scientists to expose the truth about GMOs. That is just a bit. Anyway. Let's go on to, there was a couple other things I wanted to cover tonight. Vermont lawmakers draft amendment to stop corporations from being considered people. In 2010, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in the landmark case of Citizens versus the Federal Election Commission that corporations are essentially the same as people and are thus free under the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution to participate in electioneering communications or political advertising and contribution campaigns. But lawmakers from the state of Vermont have put forth a resolution that, if passed, will amend the U.S. Constitution to state that only human beings are personally guaranteed constitutional protections. By Natural News. Excuse me. The Citizens United case deals with whether or not corporations are free to fund political campaigns and contribute to advertising efforts in the same way that individuals are. Prior to the 2010 declaration, corporate spending provisions had been in place to protect the election system from being dominated and controlled by powerful corporate interests. But all that changed when activist judges decided to overturn these projections, our protections for the people. In a recent dissent before the Supreme Court, Justice Paul Stevens reiterated the truth about corporations in an effort to draw attention to the absurdity of considering corporations to be the same as human beings. Corporations have no consciences, no beliefs, no feelings, no thoughts, no desires, he wrote. Corporations help structure and facilitate the activities of human beings, to be sure, and their parent personhood often serves as a useful legal fiction. But they are not, we themselves, members of we the people by whom and for whom our Constitution was established. And redefining parenthood, or personhood rather, and to conclude corporations opens wide the floodgates of corruption to taint the entire election process even worse than it is already. And corporations like Monsanto, for example, are free to contribute as much as they wish to politicians and their campaigns under the ruling, allowing them to steer the policy in their favor. And the Vermont resolution, which is the first of its kind to be put forth, plainly states that corporations are not persons under the laws of the United States. Also states that the profit and institutional survival of the large corporations are often in direct conflict with the essential needs and rights of human beings, adding that corporations have used their so-called rights to successfully seek the judicial reversal of democratically enacted laws. And that's what's going on there, folks. So, you know, you might want to hope that the Vermont Sears get this thing together. It'd be great to be able to overthrow the federal law, you know. makes sense. And instead of talking, I wanted to read this one because I thought I feel we must as much as we can keep the plight of the people who suffer under the British Petroleum mess in the Gulf Coast. There are thousands of people that are dying down there and have terrible diseases. 68% of the oil has not been, or 68 square miles, or 68% of the oil hasn't been cleaned up. The fishermen are getting only one third. They're being paid one third of the loss, okay, of their business, even though they verified they made $100,000 and they're only getting 30. All right, this kind of crap. When BP is supposed to have, paid them for future, for present and future losses, based on their pollution of the ocean. So they're getting a raw deal down there in every way around. And I just wanted to read this and support them and try to clarify what's going on down there, because there's little news about it. April 20th, 2011 marks the one-year anniversary of BP's catastrophic oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. That's one day from today. That's Wednesday. On this day in 2010, the Deepwater Horizon oil rig exploded, causing oil to gush from the 5,000 feet below the surface into the ninth largest body of water on the planet. At least 4.9 million barrels of BP oil would eventually be released into the Gulf of Mexico before the well was capped 87 days later. It is, to date, the largest accidental marine oil spill in the history of the petroleum industry. BP has used at least 1.9 million gallons of toxic dispersant to sink the oil in an effort the oil giant claimed was aimed at keeping the oil from reaching shore. Hang on a second. Critics believe the chemical dispersants were used simply to hide the oil and minimize BP's responsibility for environmental fines. Earlier this month, Transocean Limited, the owner of the Deepwater Horizon, gave its top executive bonuses for achieving what it described as the best year in safety performance in our company's history. Transocean CEO Steve Newman's bonus was $374,062. BP has plans to restart deep water drilling on 10 wells in the Gulf of Mexico this summer after being granted permission by U.S. legislators. Meanwhile, marine and wildlife biologists, toxicologists, and medical doctors have described the impact of the disaster upon the environment and human health as catastrophic, and have told Al Jazeera that this is only the beginning of what they expect to be an environmental and human health crisis that will likely span decades. The demise of Gulf vertebrates. Less than 4 months after the disaster began, very large fish kills began to appear along the coast of Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida. And on August 18th, a team from Georgia, Sea Grant, and University of Georgia released a report that estimated 70-79% of the oil that gushed from the well has not been recovered and remains a threat to the ecosystem. More recent studies estimate the figure could be closer to 90%. And Dr. Ed Cake, a biological oceanographer, as well as a marine and oyster biologist, has great concern about the fish kill over the last year, and which he believes are likely directly related to the BP oil disaster. In recent months, more than 290 corpses of dolphins and their newborn have washed ashore in the areas of the Gulf Coast most heavily affected by the disaster, and along the scores of dead and endangered sea turtles. If we use several models to see what is going on, the sea turtles and neonatal dolphin deaths, the impact of the dispersed oil are lingering. Cake told Al Jazeera, the oil oil is out there and still coming onto our shores. And in May 20th of this of last year, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency told BP it had 24 hours to find a less toxic alternative to its dispersant, but the EPA request was ignored. Then, on May 25, BP was given a directive by the EPA to scale back their spraying of the Gulf of Mexico with dispersants, and the U.S. Coast Guard overlooked the EPA's directive and provided BP with 74 exemptions in 48 days. 74 exemptions in 48 days to use the dispersants. And a March 1987 report titled Organic Solvent Neurotoxicity by the Natural Institute for Occupational Safety and Health states, the acute neurotoxic effect of organic solvent exposures in workers and laboratory animals are narcocesanathinesia, whatever that is, central nervous system, depression, respiratory arrest, unconsciousness, and death. Dispersants are banned in 19 countries, including UK. Cake's assessment of sea turtle and dolphin population in the Gulf is bleak. The two models of the turtle and dolphin indicate that something is drastically wrong in the marine environment that, I believe, point toward the demise of these vertebrates in the Gulf. Underscoring his concern, a new study published in Conservation Letters in this March reveals that the true impact of BP's oil disaster on wildlife may be gravely understated. And the studies argue that fatality figures based on the number of recovered animal carcasses will not give a true death toll, but may be 50 times higher than believed since most carcasses sink before they are spotted. Excuse me. Cake believes the National Marine Fisheries Service and National Oceanic and Administrative Atmospheric Administration have been remiss in determining the cause of the deaths. In the years since the spill began, NOAA admits to doing no tissue sampling, which to me is scientifically incredible, for if you have forensic samples, you are bound by protocol to have them analyzed right away, so they do not degrade. And unless your purpose is not to know what is killing these dolphins, he said. And in February, the Obama administration, via the National Marine Fisheries Service, issued a gag order to force marine scientists who were contracted to document the spikes in dolphin mortality and to collect specimens and tissue samples to keep their findings confidential. Holy shit. Now, so now you got, so the Obama administration was there, is putting a gag order on everybody. It's amazing. A bleak prognosis. Dolphins and sea turtles can be considered the canaries in the coal mine in the Gulf, since they are at the top of the food chain and directly reflect what is happening to the marine environment in which they live. All right. Ed Cake, a biological oceanographer, as well as a marine and oyster biologist, has great concern about the fish kills over the last year, which he feels are likely directly related to BP oil disaster. And adult dolphins' systems are picking up whatever is in the system out there. And we know the oil is out there and working its way up the food chain through the food web, and dolphins are at the top of that food chain. Cake explained, the chemicals then move into the lipids, fat, and then when they are pregnant, their young rely on this fat, and so it's no wonder dolphins have developed issues with stillbirths. And since last fall, Wilma Suber, a chemist and MacArthur Fellow, has been conducting tests on seafood and sediment samples upon the coast for chemicals present in the crude oil and toxic dispersants. And it has shown significant levels of oil pollution in oysters and crabs along the Louisiana coastline. And Subra told Al Jazeera, we have also also found high levels of hydrocarbons in the soil and vegetation. And the article is quite long, and I don't think I'll read it all, but I highly recommend that you check it out. And it's written by Dar Jamal, who is an excellent reporter, and it's written for Ukrnet, it's posted, rather, by Ukrnet, which is urukne.info. You can check that out. Good Middle Eastern paper website. And I guess that about ends what I had to show tonight. There was one more audio that I wanted to play tonight, if I can find it. There's one. another con game. Hold on one second here. I'm going to be... Where am I? Hold on one second. Financial scam behind the rise in oil and food prices. It's by Danny Schechter, writing for Global Research CA. And the global economy and its recovery and the living standard of millions of plain folk are now at risk from the sudden rise in oil and commodity prices. Gas at the pump is up and going higher. Food prices are following. The consequences are catastrophic for the global poor, as their costs go up while their income doesn't. It's menacing American workers, too, who in their large part have not been had a meaningful raise since the days of Reagan. Keeping it this way is clearly behind the current flurry of attacks on unions. Already unrest in the Middle East and many African countries is being blamed for these dramatic increases. It seems as if this threat to global stability is being largely ignored in our media, one that treats the oil business as just another mystical world of free market trading. Why is it happening? Why all the volatility? Is oil getting scarcer, leading to price increases? Is the food cost of food similarly a reflection of naturally increasing commodity prices? While it's true that natural disasters and droughts play some role in this unchecked price inflation, it also seems apparent that something else is attracting increasing attention. Even if most of our media fails to explore what is a political time bomb, while most political leaders shrug their shoulders and ignore it. President Obama recently said there is nothing he can do about the hike in oil and food prices. Critics say the problem is that government and media outlets alike refuse to recognize what's really going on, which is unchecked speculation. And not everyone buys into the suspicion. In fact, it is one of the more intense subjects of debate in economics. Princeton University, Paul Krugman, poo-poos the impact of speculation, counterposing the traditional argument that oil prices are set by supply and demand. The Economist magazine agrees, summing up its views with a pithy phrase, speculation does not drive the oil prices, driving does. Now, I said, these guys are so friggin' arrogant. You know, they'll continue to steal from you blind no matter what. You can read the rest of that article on globalresearch.ca. It's just beyond me how people can be so unbelievably arrogant. And that's about it for tonight. I don't know don't really have anything more stimulating for you than that. Sorry I didn't bring up UFO stuff for George, but it would have been interesting. But anyway, George, I see you're still there. Are you listening?
Yeah, I'm still listening, Leo. Hi.
Hey, George. I want to thank you again for being on. Appreciate it. And, we'll talk to you next week. End the show here. And, thank everybody for listening. And talk to you next, tomorrow. Actually, tomorrow is Wednesday, so we'll talk to you on Wednesday. So take care, George.
You have a good night, Leo.
You too, George.
Yeah,
see you then. Okay. Good night. And let's see what I want to end with tonight. We'll end with Barnstormer. All right. Have a good evening, folks.